Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up, we start off with two of our favorite retailers once again killing it during earnings calls, Restoration Hardware, or RH, as they're now branded. They come back to earth a little bit in terms of share price, but we'll talk about some of their initiatives heading into next year. And we'll discuss PetSmart, who unveiled a couple of initiatives of their own over the last couple of weeks worth discussing. Once again, we're brought to you this week by MyEmma.com, as well as ProductsUp.io. We'll talk about each of them later on in the podcast. Reminder, like us, rate us, however you do access us, and check us out on Instagram or Twitter at Retail Podcast. We kick off the podcast this week with Five Below as they come through with yet another huge quarter after using the weather excuse a bit for a slower than average growth in the first quarter. And because of that, shares popped up 13% to an all-time high after Thursday's second quarter release. That would be Thursday, September 6th. The biggest gain in terms of percentage increase for Five Below in over 3 months. And analysts, it's funny because this is a company where it seems like they continue to get the story wrong for them, but shareholders are reaping the rewards as revenue growth has been downright outstanding.
And it was not just the revenue growth, Trent. However, we will be talking about that, but earnings per share did beat by 4 cents per share during the second quarter, giving them a 50% boost in per share profitability year over year. Obvious tax benefits in there with a lower effective tax rate, thanks to the recently passed legislation, brought their effective tax rate down to around 22%. Net sales for the company increased nearly 23% to $347 million for the quarter. Laying out a small theme for this week's podcast, we see both growth in terms of revenue coming from store count and comps, contributing positively in a number of retailers, both large and small. Same-store sales rose 4-5 below 2.7%, which is actually a number that we expected to see given a strong retail economy, all of the positive earnings reports that have been coming out lately. But for some reason, average analyst estimates for same-store sales were just calling for a 0.1% increase, leaving us kind of scratching our heads because usually, even though a lot of retailers have been beating on same-store sales expectations, that number is fairly small, 4-5 below. But they opened a whopping 34 stores. Like I said, positive revenue coming in as a function of two major things here. A massive amount of new stores being opened for them. Now with 692 in 33 states, we have to wonder about the validity of their stated opportunity, however, to grow to 2,500 locations. That is their blueprint. They want over 2,500 locations inside the United States. That's a lot of locations. And they still, without a doubt, have room to grow, but we have to wonder, 2,500, is that possible? Is that going to be profitable for them? Because right now, they've been handpicking new areas in which to grow, and it's been working out for the company thus far. But new stores are performing well per management, which, as always, means that the teams there are doing the location due diligence correctly and identifying retail hotspots. Of course, not always about traffic counts, as you'll hear on a number of other podcasts that talk about commercial real estate, but existing tenants is extremely important, both in terms of the shared spaces that they occupy and the outparcels in newer development. In fact, a lot of brokers talk about how important it is to place future tenants and keep current tenants in those lease renewals in place and asking them, are you okay with this location? Is there anything else you want? Are you thinking about having some more traffic with a new QSR, maybe in an outparcel? All of those things come into play, especially when you're looking at newer areas that are under development. They still seem to be targeting newer areas to that point, which will safeguard traffic declines, at least in the short term. Everyone's talking about the retail apocalypse, or at least they were a year ago, no longer. But their teams at Five Below are looking for what they call vibrant, and I quote, vibrant shopping centers still to this day. So many flourishing locations in LA have been targeted per management, 25 stores total in California now. And by the way, they touted that 9 of their 34 new stores for the quarter hit grand opening sales records. So again, it's all about being able to sustain that growth and have it be a profitable way of expanding out your business.
Let's talk now about product mix for Five Below. Always at the forefront when it comes to analysts, it seems like. We've covered ad nauseum, of course, several analyst reports that have come out questioning whether Five Below can stay ahead of trends. And it's apparent to this point that Five Below is doing just that. They did disclose having 4% more inventory per store, but the company noted that it was really just the timing of some accounting reports, that and keeping up with those strong comp sales that Layton mentioned. More import receipts from the calendar shift that they experienced as well. They reminded listeners on the earnings call that inventory is accounted as it leaves the supplier as far as Five Below's balance sheet. But in terms of their merchandise mix, it seems to be more of the same. Five Below's buyers have been on a roll over the last 3 to 4 years with trendy merchandise. And while it seems like a never-ending process of trying to identify the right trends, they do have multiple departments to address. Everyone focuses on the fidget spinners, and granted, those are still popular, and actually, that was one of the first specific items management mentioned on the call. But Five Below has 8 total worlds, as they call their different departments. Overall, elevated brands did well, and their Star Wars gear in particular in that elevated brand group fared well. Adding value through known brands with Five Below and having a strong selection will, at least in management's minds, increase the customer base, which in turn will drive traffic and average basket, both of which are up for Five Below over the last 3 years. For a niche retailer like them that targets an elevated demographic, it's really all about store presentation, and they make it clear that first-time visitors need to be wowed. This is something that comes up earnings call after earnings call, after investor relations report, after presentation at conferences. Speaking of customer experience, all checkouts for Five Below are actually getting a new point of sale system in place by the holidays. They have a new chief information officer with a retail background to help oversee the IT functions made necessary by putting a new point of sale system in place. And with that, looking ahead into quarter three, seems to be another source of pride for the management team, as back-to-school sales were strong, as were dorm supplies, at least in the first couple of weeks of the third quarter. We've seen multiple articles about how college dorm room supplies have been sort of a hidden area of opportunity for many retailers. It's one that Target has exploited for some time now. But larger retailers, like Target, have devoted entire areas of their stores to fill that void more recently. And they've included clear new signage addressing college dorm rooms to go along with it. And for Five Below, these categories will be hybridized in a way. They're looking to have some more permanent college-oriented items, but they're also strategically focused on celebrating moments, so to speak. And they're going to be treating areas of seasonality like you would see for Mother's Day or 4th of July. But in terms of the merchandise mix overall for Five Below, they've been able to prove analysts wrong time and again. And I think they're looking forward to that again in the third quarter. They feel like they've been able to adjust their merchandise mix based on not only trends, but also the customer type coming in. That's what we're seeing with the college dorm additions. They're seeing different additions and subtractions to each of the 8 new worlds that they feel like are going to serve them well here as they close out the fiscal year.
If you look at how Five Below is going to succeed in the coming year or the rest of 2018 and beyond, you really have to look at their product mix. You have to look at their product selection and how they stay on top of their game. That is their number one competitive advantage in my view and our view. And I think, honestly, identifying the right trends, the right moments to feature new things, and like they said on the call, trying to keep it a little bit segmented to where you have some constant items, some themes that customers can come in and they know that they can get those college-oriented items at any time of the year, but then also really pushing out those other seasonal areas like 4th of July, like Memorial Day, like Mother's Day, like Father's Day. That's extremely important to get new traffic into your stores because you can really have that influence with the marketing campaigns that surround those times of year. The last note regarding their day-to-day products includes the almighty toy category, which we will talk about in our next story in Aldi's Bargain Outlet. But for Five Below, directly, they cited Toys R Us and their absence in the overall market and how there's an obvious need to fill that toy void. They are looking to spend a lot more time over the next year to innovate and search for products that they can bring in. The one downside I would say is on the call, you get the feeling like they are addressing the toy category issue and how they need to have more toys in their stores. But it seems as though they want to take a little bit of time. They want to take a step back and see exactly what the customers are demanding. They don't want to do it wrong. And we saw this as most recently as JCPenney when they said that they needed a little bit more of the elevated brand of toy. They need those big name toys in their stores, and they failed to do so during this last holiday season, which may have hurt their top line revenue. But for Five Below, I would say they have a smart team around them. They've been identifying the right products, the right trends thus far. So I don't know why they would be so hesitant in the toy category, but we will see how that goes for the rest of this year and into 2019. But for this year, full year guidance, they raised net sales estimates and same store sales. That really did please long-term investors and analysts alike. Shares, like we said, hitting all-time highs this week. Friday's closing price was $130.89 per share, leaving them with a total market valuation of around $7.2 billion. Price-to-earnings ratio, Trent, a little bit pricey there. If you focus on that metric, 63 times. And shares started off at 2018 around $69. So just in terms of capital gains, you really could be pleased if you've been a longtime shareholder.
I know a lot of retailers ask how they can push their sales on Facebook, whether or not they're even reaching the right audience on Facebook, or the fact that they might be losing track of which audience they're reaching. Well, if you're anything like those retailers that have those Facebook-related questions, look, it's always a problem to find the right audience and address users at any stage of the sales funnel. But what if there was a way to make sure your ads were shown to the right people across different verticals with different creatives?
Imagine if you were able to have all your Facebook ads accurate, auto-corrected, and that you could publish your entire product catalog in just a few clicks. You could stop losing market share. You can sell more products to the relevant target group. All this is possible. You can push your product and product feed quickly and easily to Facebook, and also take your feed from good to great using your marketing's full potential.
Get your complete campaign guide to Facebook dynamic ads. Get ready to master your Facebook ad account and learn to be more performance driven than ever in order to ensure your profitability and business growth. Download the campaign guide to Facebook dynamic ads on productsup.io/campaign guide. Again, productsup.io/campaign guide.
Well, we start off our second story with one of our favorite retailers. If you've been a longtime listener, you know that we get excited for Ollie's Bargain Outlet, and they continued their upward path, albeit at a slower pace of expansion than Five Below. But their 40 cents per share in terms of earnings beat average estimates of 37 cents, up over 48% year over year. And we just talked about Five Below. They were 50% year over year in terms of earnings per share growth. So not bad for Ollie's Bargain Outlet. They sold $288 million worth of merchandise, nearly a $4 million beat over expectations and a 13% increase over 2017. Thanks again, remember that theme we talked about, to more stores and better performing stores that have been open at least 1 year. Same store sales hit 4.4%, which was much better than the company had expected. Mostly a function, however, of customers spending a bit more. So average basket was up still, 17 straight quarters of comp growth. You'll get there however you get there, and they are pleased with that. CEO Mark Butler credited weather, allowing them to sell warm, specific items. And he also mentioned that two-thirds of the department comping positive for the second quarter. And despite growing at a fast rate, Ollie's increased their operating margin as well, reining in selling general and administrative expenses. And this was something that we did not expect. You do not expect this. Even though Ollie's Bargain Outlet has been around for over 35 years, this is a company that is fairly new on the stock market and has been just explosive in terms of growth and growth potential. This is one of those things you have to kind of scratch your head at. They're already looking at trying to reduce a lot of expenses. And so they cited those tight cost controls as part of their product acquisition end. And this is interesting because you would think that this would be a company that should maybe focus on cost controls later on when they're a little bit more mature, when their revenue is not growing quite as fast, but this is a good thing for the company, and it really proved out in terms of their net income potential for this particular quarter. The one downside is that gross margins did contract, now 39.1% of sales. Still, 39% of sales. That is a really good mark for gross margins. Those pesky transportation costs countered some of the better deal flow that they've been having as of late. And I mentioned deal flow, they've actually been able to get products at a cheaper rate. However, fuel costs, paying people to drive trucks, those are all going up for all retailers, not just Ollie's Bargain Outlet. All in all, you look at their total net income, it was up over 51% over the prior year's second quarter. Net income per share, like we said, rose around 50%, partially due to the tax benefits and stock-related compensation.
Let's look at the details in this call. And again, CEO Mark Butler and company. It's one of our favorite earnings calls to always get on because not only are they very transparent, but it seems like they are always upbeat about their own business. You don't get the same vibe from all CEOs. Some are more optimistic than others, and Butler would definitely be in the optimism bin. Granted, I'm sure a lot of longtime listeners are wondering why once a quarter this becomes the Ollie's Bargain Outlet Power Hour podcast instead of the Retail Focus podcast, but we just love Ollie's story of a retailer that's been around for 30-plus years, but they're really hitting their stride in terms of their growth story as they continue to grow from East Coast into the West. Now, as far as categorical sales for Ollie's, most categories, as Leighton mentioned, remain strong, two-thirds comping positive. These included housewares, automotive, rugs, and electronics. Regarding toys, and we'll talk about Toys R Us implications in a second, Butler said, and I quote, "They are locked and loaded." Going forward, Butler said that toys will command the biggest and best location in the store. Now, we're not 100% sold necessarily on toys being a huge revenue driver for them, but they claim it will add significantly to comps in the final two quarters. One of the reasons they increased their overall comp estimates for the next two quarters. Their executive vice president and COO, John Swigert, also got on the call and mentioned the fact that Ollie's isn't exactly a Johnny-come-lately when it comes to toys. That toys have been a key category for 36 years for Ollie's, and he maintained that this positioning, particularly in longtime markets for them, will allow them to execute on their recent acquisitions of product, some of which, of course, coming from the Toys R Us ordeal. Swigert did also mention potential negative impacts from toys expanding in their stores, from cannibalization with toys taking square footage away from other categories. But still, they feel as though positive impacts from expanded toy focus, particularly in the last two quarters, will more than overcome cannibalization effects, one of the reasons they raised their overall comp guidance. Ollie's, by the way, now officially in Louisiana, which was one of the six stores they opened in the quarter. They now have 282 stores in 22 states, so a little less than half of the total number of stores Five Below has, as we talked in our first story. But they do see 36 to 38 total new stores for 2018. They mentioned their runway potential is said to be near 1,000, and we believe it considering they're barely west of the Mississippi. They've only got a few stores west of the Mississippi. A lot of white space still to go in the United States. And from their website, they're clear about what they need in order to expand to a particular market. And to be honest, Leighton, it isn't much. New stores range in size from 25,000 to 35,000 square feet, a little bit smaller than some of their initial stores. They actually say on their website, and I quote, "We don't require much. Just give us a vanilla box and a concrete floor." And nothing could be closer to the truth if you've ever been to an Ollie's Bargain Outlet store. New stores, they mentioned, can be in new or existing markets, but as they're expanding, as we talked about before on the podcast, they like to expand to states contiguous to where they already have a presence. We mentioned, of course, them just expanding into Louisiana after earlier this year expanding into Arkansas. Now, a recurring question we've had looks at whether or not they can match demand and growth with supply of items. Management said that it is continuing momentum and that there are more deals thanks to a growing vendor list. These include toy buyouts, which they said they tried to get in front of in terms of that category because of all the disruption with the Toys R Us stores closing. But as a result of the increased vendor list, inventory was up 13.6%. They credited both new store openings and timing of deal flow as reasons for the increase in inventory. Deal flow for them is crucial. Now, as we've kind of alluded to, we've expressed concerns in the past about whether their low price acquisition can keep pace with their countrywide expansion. Other similar retailers, you think of Big Lots about 20 years ago, struggled to keep that deal flow going strong, and that resulted in increasing prices passed on to customers and eventual reimagining of their concept, which is something we're seeing right now. Now, as far as Ollie's is concerned, inventory is something we keep a big eye on each quarter, and in this case, promising to see growth in this regard. In comparison to store count, which is important to use when talking about inventory growth, inventory growth is actually slightly outpacing store openings. Their store count was up 12.8% year over year for the second quarter, where those inventories, again, were up 13.6%, meaning some crucial controlled growth outside of those new stores.
Speaking of new stores, this has been crucial for their revenue growth as trend is outlined, but you really have to consider, how are they going to be able to fill these new stores in new markets if they don't have the right deal flow, if they don't have the proper inventory levels to fill these new stores for all those new customers? Well, Trent, they've been addressing all of the issues, and they've really been identifying as well how they can sustain and drive out new store growth in a profitable way. And I think one way they can do this is to actually purchase the real estate. So yes, they are sort of a plain setup. They don't need a whole lot to operate. Like they said, a vanilla box and a concrete floor will do just fine for the retailer. However, we always talk about lease rates and how lease rates often have options that creep up the lease rate in due time. Maybe increases every 3 to 5 years, and that really hurts the bottom line for a lot of these retailers that are trying to kill it and are trying to really mitigate those costs that are day-to-day, like fuel costs, all those transportation costs, and gross margins, trying to keep those in check as well, because you never know if deal flow is ever going to run out in the future. So they have to make sure that everything's in place so that they can sustain during a hard time. Well, Trent, to address these issues, this quarter, they purchased 12 Toys R Us locations and secured 5 other Toys R Us leases. So previous stores that were Toys R Us's, they're leasing 5 and they now own 12. This really pleased us on the call because they're looking to, again, be a little bit more opportunistic in the real estate realm and making sure each location is going to be profitable for the long term. For us, always good to see them own their own real estate. And this is something that I think really differentiates Ollie's, because they think outside the box. Everything they do, they just do it. They're not really constrained by some specific model. They evolve as time goes on. And for them, that means doing whatever they feel is necessary for their customer, for their current growth pattern. Their rewards members, by the way, or what they call the Ollie's Army, now has 10 million members, or almost 10 million, 9.8 to be specific. After their first quarter earnings call, we spoke about how members usually spend more on average, and this is still the case for them. They say that the Ollie's Army reward system really has been driving traffic. And by the way, they have a new app out, and their app has integrated features as well. Customers can track their reward status as well as new deals that are arriving at specific locations. So they're going to get that heads up. So let's say they're going to expand their toy selection. They're going to be sending out marketing campaigns on their app. So I think that's really going to help them. It's really going to help in terms of relaying that message to the customers that visit the store the most. But again, we always have to remind those in the executive suite to not spam your customers, especially the most loyal ones that were already signing up for the rewards program. And you really don't want to alienate those customers. They are always going to analyze the results here, especially with the app, so they can add value as time goes on. They really want to start drawing correlations. If a customer buys X, are they going to buy Y? So I think that's extremely important. This is something they had talked about roughly 1.5 years ago, saying that they want to be able to get to that point. And I think we are almost there now in 2018. Management increased revenue guidance, same store sales guidance, and earnings per share for the full fiscal year. So all three were increased on both ends of the expected ranges. So both the bottom end of the guidance and the top end of the guidance, same store sales in particular, up a full percent and the highest forecast in Butler's tenure. We should note that they are fairly often exceeding internal guidance for comps. So the fact that they themselves increased forecasted comps this high, extremely impressive, and we're curious to see if they beat given those revised expectations. They did mention some slight negative impacts expected from the costs associated from opening the former Toys R Us locations, about 1 penny per share. Shares popped over 5% to, just like Five Below, all-time highs Friday, where it ended up closing around $92.50 per share. Those all-time highs represent a market cap for Ollie's right around $5.7 billion, price-to-earnings ratio a little bit cheaper than Five Below, around 41 times earnings.
Here's some advice for anyone that sends emails to their customers, which, as we've talked about here already in the podcast, it seems like just about every retailer, no matter how large or small. Look, you deserve a better email marketing platform, one that's actually designed with your type of organization in mind. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first, offering powerful email marketing with a personal touch.
With Emma, you'll have everything you need to connect your data, build your audience, and do your most successful marketing ever. Because their easy-to-use platform makes advanced functionality accessible to everyone on your team with no technical skills required, more people can use it. You can even connect Emma with the services you count on day-to-day to run your business, like Salesforce and Google Analytics. Not to mention, Emma's award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and much, much more.
So put the power of email experts behind your marketing. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma, E-M-M-A.com.
Formerly known as Restoration Hardware, RH released their second quarter results on Tuesday, and while they were improved from a year ago, they didn't live up to the lofty hype set by the market, or at least the tone that the market has set. As a result, their stock fell from $159 a share last Friday, August 31st, to a low of $122 on Thursday before increasing Friday to close the week just over $126 per share. Motley Fool on their podcast said this week that their stock may have gotten a little ahead of the story, which is something we've hinted at actually for a while. Seeing all of that volatility built into that stock price over the last year and a half, it's pretty incredible. We couldn't agree more with the Motley Fool, even if they were more profitable. We look at the earnings details from this quarter. Analyst expectations coming into the call were calling for earnings per share to come in around $1.75 and revenue to come in around $660 million. Well, RH, again, Restoration Hardware. I keep wanting to say Restoration Hardware, but RH killed it on the adjusted earnings per share front, coming in around $2.49 per share, a 42% beat, astounding. Even on the GAAP front, they killed it. Looking at those numbers, they would have actually beaten there as well, with earnings per share of $2.33 per diluted share on revenue. They did have a slight miss. We mentioned those expectations of $660 million. Well, top line revenue came in at $640.8 million. This, however, still was positive for them in terms of looking back towards their performance in 2017, up 4.1% year over year. As we'll talk about, Trent, the company was extremely excited about the margin growth, but analysts were lukewarm because the revenue miss. So it's sort of taking one for missing the other. Speaking of their operating margins, their second quarter GAAP operating margins came in at 13.3%, adjusted still at 12.3% versus 6.4% a year ago. So if we were executives in this company, we would be excited too. That is a really good operating margin for the company. They did mention a slight negative impact on margins because of higher advertising costs reflected due to an accounting change. This is a company that's going to be intensive in terms of advertising and marketing effort. They have an elevated brand. Their demographic is different. They're going to have to advertise, and whether or not it's an accounting change in the future, these costs are going to be up. These are costs that cannot be avoided if you're an executive at RH in the marketing realm. And oh, if you're looking at the same store sales metrics, well, they use comparable brand revenue as their metric of choice. That was up 5% over the second quarter last year, on top of a 7% increase in last year's second quarter. So overall, those locations, again, they're sort of retail apocalypse proof too, because they have really focused on opening new stores and new showrooms, as we'd like to call them, in particular markets. They take their time in trying to really focus on what market is going to do the best in terms of driving all of their revenue, driving traffic to their site. This is all very important for them. It's not as though they're building out as aggressively as a Five Below or an Ollie's Bargain Outlet.
And while you mentioned they might be retail apocalypse proof, they may, however, be not altogether recession-proof, and we'll talk about that here in a second. Now, let's talk about the call, and the earnings call itself was interesting. Now, first of all, CEO Gary Friedman jumped right into analyst questions, and if you've never been on an earnings call, this is a kind of unusual step to begin with, because typically they start off just reading the facts that are in the earnings release, but instead, Friedman just referenced the letter that he had penned and was posted on the Restoration Hardware, or RH, again, investor relations page. It was a letter to shareholders that had the tone as though it was almost written after he downed a case of Red Bull. I've never seen a CEO, and we talked about Mark Butler just now, I've never seen a CEO that has been as bullish about his company, and we're going to quote him several times during the course of this story. Not something we usually do, but in the letter, and I quote this, he said, "In my 40-plus years in the retail industry spanning three leading platforms, I can honestly say I've never seen an organization as clear and as focused on optimizing a business as RH is today." Well, the call itself started from almost a contentious place. Analyst Chuck Grom from Gordon Haskett asked Friedman about the revenue miss that Leighton mentioned and downward revenue revisions for the rest of the year. And Friedman's response was that, well, it's hard to be disappointed when gross margins are up 800 basis points year over year. He also said in his response, and again, I quote, "So people are unhappy with the fact that we took earnings up 14% and took revenues down 2%. Honestly, that's their problem. Our focus is to optimize this business this year and position ourselves through the long term," before he trailed off. It was refreshing to see an executive be this assertive on a call about a company's plan, regardless of whether we agree necessarily with their plan. And in this case, their plan is essentially maximizing margins on what they do sell. It was a constant theme throughout the earnings call. Essentially, their idea, if we can maximize margins on what we do sell, top line revenue, same store sales, those metrics may not matter so much if we can increase that margin. In fact, driving home this point, Friedman talked about how people called RH crazy at the beginning of the year because they were looking for 9 to 10% operating margins. Fast forward to now, and they've increased their outlook for 2018 in the full year to 11 to 12% operating margins, which, again, in their particular segment, that is notable. Friedman noted that they could post a lot higher revenues, but it would come at the cost of margins eventually, which isn't a long-term success plan, and that was our main argument against some of their membership plans and some of their discount programs they rolled out in 2016 to try and combat the fact that their supply chain was lagging behind demand. To summarize, Friedman noted that they expect to see 50 to 70% more earnings than anyone else in their sector when the RH transformation is done. Now, from our perspective, this is basically the only way RH can be operationally viable long-term, because they do continue to struggle slightly with traffic and customer retention as lower price alternatives like at home have success. And one of the other things going forward is whether or not they can continue to bring in new customers. So if you can at least make money from your present customers, even if traffic is slightly down or ticket price is slightly down or revenue doesn't come in where it's expected, we should mention, by the way, that revenue is still up year over year. But even if you had a circumstance where revenue was declining slightly, the key is for them that their operating margin is still going up.
What we found most interesting in the call is Friedman's breakdown of wealth in the world. This was, of course, germane to the call because of the segment RH serves, but recall also that RH has worked over the past year to trim the number of outlet stores that it has in an effort to both boost gross margin and reestablish its premium positioning. Although we were and are still somewhat critical of this move in particular, Friedman said that they see a $4 to $5 billion opportunity in North America, perhaps even greater if you look in a wider scope, longer term. The main reason for this, he noted, is that one-third of the world's billionaires live in America, and 15 to 20% of the billionaires actually live in the United States. The idea, although not explicitly stated, is to exploit those higher income brackets in order to boost margins long-term. As in the premium and ultra-premium wine segment, the premium and ultra-premium furniture segment features enormous margins, thus the reason for the endeavor to reestablish brand positioning here in the United States. And so We have to look at our takeaway here, and we see that while we agree with RH's need to differentiate themselves from lower-end competitors, we think that they need to do a better job of fueling interest among those that will one day be able to afford their products. So you're looking at middle-class individuals, upper-middle-class individuals, and as with any Veblen good seller, marketing must be at the forefront, but outreach is part of it too. So you have to reach out to your customers in a number of ways. And while we were fairly critical of the rewards program for eroding margins for the company when they rolled it out in 2016, we were bullish towards their outlet store initiatives, bringing in the common consumer to get a little more familiarized with their product selection. Outlet stores often serve as the first exposure to certain brands for middle-class families. When we look at the brand recognition that the likes of the North Face have been able to fuel through their outlet sales, leading to full price sales later on as individuals grow up and have more income, we find it hard to believe that maintaining their outlet positioning would hurt RH long term. And this is something that we've really been beating the drum on. However, they have a particular mission and it seems as though they are set on it. So far be it for us to really guide RH through this, but we do think that having those outlet sales would be an integral piece for RH's future. And speaking of future, we mentioned the positives insofar as upward guidance on earnings, but there are a few other things to note here as well. First, RH's commitment to opening up more of their gallery showroom style stores over the next 2 years. Leadership mentioned that their growth probably won't accelerate much in terms of their new store development in 2019. But they're looking to ramp up growth in 2020. Again, this is something that I've been saying is that they are taking their time. They're taking their time expanding into newer markets. Additionally, they're working with a secondary gallery concept that will encompass around 10,000 to 18,000 square feet per location. Additionally, fans of RH can expect them to release two new product lines in 2019, RH Beach House and RH Color. They feel as though these lines will balance out their penchant for a more neutral look for their customers. They see a potential for a 25% boost for the brand based on these two new product lines alone. And honestly, Trent, this is a company that is sort of all over the place. But when you go to LA, if you go to Sunset Boulevard, you see a million different competitors for RH. If they're really able to establish a brand here, especially in these two niches, I'm curious to see if they can either garner more market share or really create something that can be really expanded out throughout different parts of the United States in a successful manner. Overall, while Friedman is extremely bullish on the company's current path, we still believe that RH is a highly volatile space because of said competition and other factors, especially as they get away from hedging their own outlet store concept. Were there to be any kind of economic downturn in the immediate future, they would likely struggle to find footing. But as long as things are going smoothly and upper middle class grows in North America, they will continue to see robust margins and robust traffic. We go back to our go-to retail analyst in Neil Saunders with Global Data Retail, who noted that the continued success of off-price chains, including Home Goods, may not bode well for the higher-end brands going forward if there were to be an economic hiccup. We see the likes of Ross and others, TJ Maxx, doing extremely well lately. If there were a major economic downturn, we would probably see the firmly upper class being partially insulated from that, but it's those upper middle class individuals that you would have to worry about in terms of going to your stores like RH in the future.
We close out the news portion of today's show with PetSmart, as they were in the news twice over the last week after launching a new loyalty program and seeking to expand a recent acquisition. Because they are private retailer, we don't often get a lot of information from PetSmart, but the two announcements over the last couple of weeks we felt like deserved mentioning on the podcast. Now, PetSmart already had an existing loyalty program. We'll talk about that in a second. They announced a partnership with Aimia to launch PetSmart Treats across 1,600 locations. PetSmart Treats, I'm not talking about dog or cat treats. I'm talking about the name of the loyalty program. It's called PetSmart Treats. Now, looking at Aimia's expertise, generally it's in the travel and hospitality rewards program space. They've partnered with airlines, rental car operators, and hotels specifically in the past. They actually just named a new CEO in May of this year, and this is their first new publicly noted retail partnership in several years. But this PetSmart Treats program appears to have replaced the Pet Perks loyalty program they've had in place up to this point. Other than providing savings on sale items, just like any rewards card that you would have at a grocer or general merchandise retailer, there really weren't any tangible rewards for members, at least that we could tell. I know my household personally, we spent hundreds at PetSmart last year, and other than the savings at the point of sale, there were no other apparent perks to the Pet Perks program. But the new Treats loyalty program is being supported by a double banner on PetSmart's website and through other marketing. There are other benefits to this program other than point of sale savings, which apparently will continue, including Treats members being able to save 5% on in-store pickup when they buy items online. Other than that benefit, which is an extension of their ongoing omnichannel efforts, the program offers 8 points for every dollar spent in stores and online. This includes pet services spending as well, think things like grooming, training, and so forth. Additionally, points are earned for donating to PetSmart charities, which, as any visitor to PetSmart knows, customers are always asked to do at checkout. They also get free shipping on orders above $49 placed at PetSmart's website if you're a Treats member, a free surprise on your pet's birthday if you happen to know your pet's birthday, and bonus points for doing profile-related things on their website, which allows PetSmart to, in theory, dig deeper into their customer demographics. Now, how are the points redeemable for customers? Well, customers can redeem points up to a year after earning on either purchases of products or services. Customers begin getting, in quotes, treats at 1,000 points. Not really sure we're clear what treats mean, but their points can be redeemed via their mobile app in stores. And I feel like that's the one setback with this particular program. As Leighton mentioned earlier, customers are increasingly noting clutter on their phones via both apps and push notifications. So there may be a little bit of pushback on this front. And the one concern going forward may be convincing people to give up their information a second time, especially if you were already a Pet Perks member. However, this program does appear robust enough to perhaps entice customers to sign up for yet another rewards program, but we shall see. You know, PetSmart, as I mentioned, they're privately held, so any updates on the program will likely come from Aimia, which is publicly traded and Canada-based, so we'll keep a close eye on their website and their news releases to see how this new rewards program is going.
PetSmart, as Trent just said, is a privately held institution, and they bought Chewy.com for an undisclosed amount of money. However, there are rumors around how much it costs, but they are looking to expand Chewy.com and placing a $7 million hub for Chewy.com in various areas of Louisville, Kentucky, as a contender creating as many as 300 jobs. Chewy.com, for those who don't know, is a fairly well-known website that sells pet treats from multiple brands. And while we don't have too many financial details because both Chewy.com was private at the time of the buyout and PetSmart is private currently, it is pretty clear that the platform has seen strong sales success and growth year over year. Within its first 5 years, reportedly they hit $1 billion in sales. That's a lot of pet treats, Trent. And like I said, sold over a year ago to PetSmart for a rumored $3.35 billion. And while we can't get confirmation on that number, news outlets were just taking a step back because that's more than Jet.com when Walmart purchased Jet.com not that long ago as well. Earlier this year, PetSmart actually gave back 20% of Chewy.com equity in form of a dividend back to BC Partners, the private ownership group that owns PetSmart. So they got it as sort of a dividend. Rather than cash, the owners at BC Partners said, you know what? Chewy.com is so popular and so successful that we don't even want cash. We'll just take 20% of Chewy.com in the form of a dividend. So they're looking at Chewy.com as a particularly good investment, something that's going to pay dividends in itself in the future. That speaks volumes in that the executives rather take stock in Chewy.com than, again, a cash dividend or any other sort of compensation in the near term. The company is still growing and needs help, however. It comes publicly in terms of laid out plans for a new facility, presumably for distribution. If you look through these plans in Louisville, Kentucky, there's not a lot of specifics, but the city they are eyeing is Louisville, Kentucky, so we know that part. And they have asked for some $1.25 million in tax breaks. And the city is actually committed to giving that to them. So they got the approval. But the approval is contingent upon, again, presumably a distribution center, them spending $7 million for the initial work, to build it out, and they will pay an adequate wage as well, citing a promise to pay a potentially average hourly wage of $39. Of course, this is an average. So within this $39, you're including managers and other staff members that are probably going to be a little more white collar working in planning and logistics within that factory. Overall, the Chewy.com facility is, again, calling for over 300 employees to take part. And if you look at a quote from the governor, Matt Bevin, he said, "This is a major new venture for the company that will bring significant investment and hundreds of jobs to the region. It is further confirmation that Kentucky is the established leader for logistics and distribution in the United States." And with that, Walmart actually just signed on to have an over 700,000 square foot facility. However, the details there have not been fully released yet. Documents highlight the fact that Chewy.com needs to address surging demand, and that this would make sense given that pet-related sales that take place at the two retailers discussed this week in Ollie's Bargain Outlet and Five Below have been surging. They reportedly beat out Amazon in pet sales in 2016, and Chewy.com at that time taking in 48% of the online pet sales market share, an astounding figure. And while this number is probably going to go down in the future as not only Amazon increases their pet supply market share, but other retailers as well, other competitors in this space, customers are spending much, much more year over year on their pets, something that's been a recurring theme over the last 3 years on this podcast. The average family spends over $500 on pets, around $530 to be exact, and that figure is actually going up sequentially. So last year, people spent around $28 less than they did this year. And so people are not only feeding their pets better, but social media has been spurring sales of costumes and toys. And I'm not a huge pet fan, Trent. I don't have any pets, but I see some of the things on our social media, on our Instagram, on our Twitter. Pets can do some pretty cute and amazing things. So that really does spur a lot of demand, creating high levels of demand for the products that Chewy.com has. They've done a great job of diversifying their marketing efforts. In fact, I just got a flyer in the mail for $15 off my first order. This wasn't the first flyer I got, by the way, from Chewy.com. So with this, we have to remember that driving traffic to their website can be done using conventional means, not just by pushing that digital marketing effort like with that Instagram and Twitter link that I just mentioned. But very successful retailer. Curious to see if this pans out for them. It's always nice to have your factory or distribution center subsidized, so that's going to help their bottom line as well. But for the private owners, they're extremely bullish on Chewy.com. And to be honest with you, they've done a great job at building their brand over the years, and I'm curious to see where they go from here.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where H. Layton and I tell you about a story we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year in retail, and we begin with Layton.
Well, we talked a little bit about off-price retail today, but one of the stores we have not talked about in the recent past is Burlington, as Burlington stores recently reported earnings, and this was going to be a part of the podcast, but we just had so much other stuff to talk about. We are not going to not talk about Five Below or Ollie's Bargain Outlet, but Burlington Stores, ticker BURL, publicly traded retailer, off price. You can really compare them to some of the retailers we talked about in this edition of the podcast. We talked about Ross briefly, TJ Maxx, etc. They work in that same sort of space, but some of their stores are a little bit larger. We look at their earnings release, and this is my looking ahead. You have to ask yourself, why is this Layton's looking ahead if he's just talking about the past news? Well, this is really about the future for Burlington Stores because they're promising increased same-store sales for the future, and they've been opening a lot more stores than a lot of other people had anticipated. So for them, at least, for these latest earnings results, a 35% jump in earnings to 97 cents per share, a 9.5% increase in second quarter revenue, astounding, and nearly 3% same store sales revenue. But it's really about their growth pattern and how they're going to be able to really cut costs and grow out their expected number of stores in the coming years. But if you look, Trent, for the outlook for Burlington Stores, they see third quarter earnings coming in around $1 to $1.04 per share. And this is actually below the views of some analysts. So sort of a mixed quarter for them. But however, if you look at their profitability, cutting costs for them, it's really come in handy. Full year earnings per share guidance now increased between $6.13 to $6.20 per share. And I think a lot of this has to do with the tax gain, but they are funneling that money into expansion, a lot more money into capital expenditures for them in the future. I'm really curious if they're going to be able to have a foothold because, like I said, they have a larger store footprint. It's not as though they can go into a smaller space. I know the Burlington stores that I live around, massive stores, massive amount of retail square footage that they need to manage. And in this day and age, I'm curious to see if they can remain profitable with that same store footprint.
Well, my looking ahead story has to do with the sporting goods retail sector. And in this case, we're talking about Nike. Now, unless you were living under a rock, you no doubt saw all the Nike news from this last week regarding the Colin Kaepernick advertisement, a huge loss in terms of market cap on Tuesday of this week after the long weekend. But I'm not so much looking at Nike in this circumstance. What I'm really looking at are the retailers that sell Nike products, the retailers like Finish Line and Foot Locker and Dick's Sporting Goods, who we just talked about last week. Could it be that there is some sort of Nike excuse that they may use in the future? And will sales of Nike products either slow or accelerate, and how will that impact those retailers going in either direction? There have been a few retailers throughout the country, smaller ones usually, that have actually discounted all of their Nike products in an effort to get rid of Nike products after the ad was released. And in many cases, those retailers were swamped and they took a loss on their products. One retailer, in fact, discounted all of their Nike products 50% and they were wiped out within a couple of days. And knowing what the markup is on Nike products, they for sure lost money on those sales. So that's really what I'm looking at. How are sales affected? Will they be affected positively, negatively, or will this all blow over in the end, as it seems like so much of what we see on social media with social media outrage truly happens? So that's what I'm keeping an eye on. I'll be looking forward to those earnings calls from Foot Locker and Finish Line and Dick's for this next quarter to see exactly what the impacts were, if there were any impacts from the latest happenings regarding Nike. That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Once again, check us out on Twitter or Instagram at Retail Podcast. A big thanks to MyEmma.com for supporting the podcast over the last several weeks. And once again, we'd like to thank Products Up as well for their support of the Retail Focus Podcast. And we'll be back 7 days from today.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at RetailFocusPodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.